Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. The first exhibition to focus exclusively on photographs made in the eastern half of the United States during the 19th century, east of the Mississippi, 19th century American landscape photography, showcases some 175 works, from daguerreotypes and stereographs to album imprints and cyanotypes, as well as several photographers whose efforts have often gone unheralded. Celebrating natural wonders such as Niagara Falls and the White Mountains, as well as capturing a cultural landscape fundamentally altered by industrialization, the Civil War, and tourism, these photographs not only helped shape America's national identity, but also played a role in the emergence of environmentalism. Diane Wagner introduces the exhibition in this opening day lecture recorded on March 12, 2017 at the National Gallery of Art. East of the Mississippi is on view through July 16, 2017.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Diane Wagner, curator of 19th century photographs here at the National Gallery and the organizer of the exhibition East of the Mississippi, 19th century American landscape photography, which is currently on view on the ground floor of the West Building. And my talk today will provide an overview of the exhibition. Before venturing west to capture America's frontier in paintings and photographs, 19th century artists explored the eastern landscape, which served as a powerful source of myth-making for a nation finding its identity in the 19th century. However, photography of the East has often been overshadowed by its Western counterparts, and East of the Mississippi is the first exhibition to look at the trajectory of Eastern landscape photography as its own vivid and fundamental chapter in America's photographic history. When photography arrived in the United States in 1839, the year it was introduced to the world, it first established itself in major cities in the East, from Boston and New York to Philadelphia. At the time, landscape as an artistic genre had already assumed an important place within American visual culture. Artists in America saw the expansive and variable wilderness of the young country, full of marvels such as Niagara Falls, as a vibrant vehicle of national expression that offered a native alternative to the cultivated landscape of Europe. A new generation of painters from the 1830s onward dedicated themselves to shaping a uniquely American landscape genre, venerating the specificities of the untouched wilderness at the very same time as the country's growing population began to settle it and transform it for cultural purposes. Thomas Cole, one of the leaders of this new approach, wrote his seminal text, Essay on American Scenery, in 1835, in which he elaborated on the symbolic, spiritual, and emotional resonance of the American environment, singling out the wild, Edenic beauty of the country's natural features, from its myriad mountains and forests to waterfalls, lakes, rivers, and skies. Cole also imbued the landscape with a potential for the future, suggesting that America was ripe for expansion and development. A few years later, Cole painted a view of the mountain pass called the Notch of the White Mountains in 1839, again, the very year of photography's introduction to the world. And this, of course, is on view in our American galleries upstairs on the main floor. Cole's painting of what is now called Crawford Notch in the New Hampshire area, already one of the most widely touted northeastern landscapes for its variegated beauty, did not just focus on the picturesque and sublime beauties of the valley and mountains, but with the inclusion of the roadway that allowed travelers to reach the White Mountains, the Willie House, which is the little white house that you see in the background, which was a well-known site in which a family had lost their lives in a severe storm, and cut down trees, Cole pointed to the clash of nature and culture that would preoccupy so much of 19th century American visual culture and that would soon prove to dominate Eastern landscape photography, which alternately sought to depict pristine wilderness or hailed the alteration of the landscape for human use. Over the course of the 19th century, the United States experienced profound growth and transformation, shifting from a predominantly agrarian to an industrial economy. In 1839, the country was comprised of 26 states, encompassing the original colonies along the eastern seaboard and the Midwest, including most of the states bounded by the Mississippi River. In the middle of the century, the country survived the tensions between North and South over the institution of slavery and the threat of Southern secession by the Union victory in the Civil War. By the end of the century, through westward expansion, it consisted of 46 states that extended across the entire continent. The East was also gradually threaded with a web of railroad tracks, beginning in 1830 when the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad became the first commercial railroad to open for business, and growing exponentially over the next decades. Eventually, most of the area east of the Mississippi River had in place a vast network of interconnecting steamships and trains that made travel possible for both commerce and tourism throughout the regions. The cities connected by these means of transportation became populous centers for the growing middle class and were dedicated to manufacturing, industry, trade, and consumerism. The exhibition charts the arc of landscape photography as a genre roughly east of the Mississippi River from the first extant daguerreotypes of views to the end of the century. It is by no means a comprehensive survey of every place photographed or every photographer working in the East, but traces the evolution of the genre and highlights many of its major practitioners and geographical subjects, as well as the ideas and technological modifications that drove its development. Created for multiple purposes, the photographs on view express a diverse set of aesthetic, topographic, instrumental, moral, and memorial concerns. They helped shape evolving mythologies of the American wilderness, showed the impact of the Civil War on the physical landscape, and played an important role in promoting industrialization, developing tourism, and inspiring environmental preservation. Eastern landscape photographs reveal a rich and varied practice, balancing nature and culture, country and city. They conceived a vision of a nation full of natural wonders, but also flourishing with innovation and undergoing rapid yet unstoppable change. Of the two initial photographic processes introduced to the world in January of 1839, one was the French invention of the daguerreotype, named after its creator, Louis-Jacques Mandé Daguerre, and the other was the British invention of the paper negative and print, introduced by William Henry Fox Talbot. It was the daguerreotype that flourished and dominated over the first decade and a half of photography's existence in the United States. Already by the end of 1839, a number of experimenters attempted to make daguerreotypes, often photographing the views immediately accessible to them, such as the town view by Henry Coit Perkins, a doctor in Newburyport, Massachusetts, and the view of a street in New York by scientist John Draper. At the time, Niagara Falls was already one of the most popular tourist destinations in America and the subject of numerous paintings and prints, and it proved to be one of the first landscape vistas that was sought out to be photographed. The earliest known photographs taken of the waterfall were daguerreotypes by the Northern Englishman and scientist Hugh Lee Pattinson. Traveling to America to investigate a potential mining investment, he arrived in November 1839, just around the time a Frenchman, François Gouraud, was in New York demonstrating the novel process and exhibiting daguerreotypes to an eager American audience. By the time Pattinson made his way north to Niagara, he had outfitted himself with a daguerreotype camera. He produced a group of pictures in April of 1840, including two views of the American Falls and the Horseshoe Falls shown in the exhibition, though, as it is evident, the condition of the plates has sadly deteriorated. And note, too, that the orientation of the image was laterally reversed, which, of course, was a condition of the process that was later usually corrected through the use of a mirror or prism in the camera. Pattinson's choice of Niagara as his subject and his attempt to adopt established pictorial standards in the sweeping perspective that he employed showed the possibilities of the new medium and that photography could play a role in the evolving understanding and representation of landscape within American culture. Indeed, one of Pattinson's daguerreotypes served as the basis for an engraving in Excursion Daguerrienne, an 1842 French publication of worldwide monuments all based on daguerreotypes, and it was the only North American view to be included. When François Gouraud moved on to Boston in April 1840, he sold a camera to Samuel Bemis, a Boston watchmaker and dentist who embarked on one of the first rare serial landscape projects in daguerreotypy in America. Over the next 3 years, Bemis made an extraordinary 350 daguerreotypes, of which 40 or so survive, of Boston and the White Mountains, two of which are included in the exhibition. Similar to Cole's painting from just a year or two before, in Crawford Notch and Hotel, which you see there on the left, Bemis focused on the fraught relationship between humanity and nature. In view within Crawford Notch, on the right, Bemis set up his camera looking north from the south through the narrow passage between the hills, though, like Pattinson's daguerreotypes, the image is laterally reversed, and is on the opposite side of the passageway as depicted in Cole's painting. Featuring the barren trees and the wild ruggedness of the landscape, this daguerreotype bears the hallmarks of qualities inherent to the photographic image, with its blunt cropping of the mountains and flattening of forms from foreground to background. Bemis's project, like Pattinson's at Niagara, began to reveal both the peculiarities of the medium's application to landscape and the ways it could be shaped to conform to pictorial conventions. Despite these early experiments, most daguerreotypists turned their attention to portraiture, and a burgeoning industry of daguerreotype studios developed that successfully catered to a wide range of clientele. However, landscape daguerreotypes were made, most often for commercial reasons rather than artistic ones. Many daguerreotype views that survived from this first decade and a half or so were probably made as commissions for clients, often to photograph property such as a house or a barn, or for display in exhibitions or the daguerreotype studio to advertise skill, such as William and Frederick Langenheim's 1845 five-plate daguerreotype panorama of Niagara Falls, or W.S. Porter's 1848 panorama of Fairmount Waterworks in Philadelphia. Here, these photographers adapted the panorama format, which was a form flourishing in painting in the 1840s and 1850s, as a way of attempting to encapsulate the full drama of vistas such as Niagara Falls. Platt Babbitt was the only daguerreotypist to establish a business based primarily on landscape views, and it was, not surprisingly, at Niagara Falls. Accessible both by boat from New York due to the completed Erie Canal in 1825 and by a railroad that had been completed in 1842, Niagara Falls, by the early 1850s, was a very prosperous resort with tens of thousands of tourists visiting each summer to, quote, do the falls. Setting up a pavilion, Babbitt operated a studio there during the summer season from 1853 to around 1860. There, Babbitt photographed visitors, usually from behind, in contemplation of the sublime view on the American side. Babbitt not only provided a visual record that the tourist had physically been at the falls, but he also stressed the evolving relationship between Americans and their landscape as a source of wonder to be promoted for tourism. As the first photographer to cater exclusively to visitors to the falls, Babbitt helped establish a market for souvenir landscapes. Thomas Easterly, however, pushed the potential of the daguerreotype view to its highest point in America. The majority of his daguerreotypes were made in his adopted city of St. Louis, where he set up shop by 1848, and he is unique in this context for persisting with the daguerreotype process well into the 1860s, long after most photographers had abandoned it in favor of paper processes. He created daguerreotypes remarkable for their dazzling lucidity and sensitive compositions. But Easterly in particular focused not on scenic views around the city, but on the constant changes to the city's landscape and urban fabric that he saw unfolding around him, such as the draining and redevelopment of the fetid area of Chouteau's Pond, a locale he photographed over the course of several years. In a before and after pair, Easterly first pictures the pond as if it is a tranquil landscape, despite its pollution, that's what you see there on the left, and then he returned to the site just after the pond had been drained, showing cows wandering in the barren landscape with a white lead factory behind that's belching smoke into the air. Though the daguerreotype drew the attention of most early photographers, there were some who tried their hand with the earliest incarnation of paper processes. One example was the Langenheim brothers, whose series Views in North America was an ambitious and wide-ranging undertaking, photographing city and scenic views around Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., and Niagara Falls and surrounding areas, which unfortunately found little commercial success, so there are very few prints surviving from that series. And another is the early 1850s work by Robert Montgomery Bird, a Philadelphia area writer who made paper negatives and salted paper prints, mostly in his Philadelphia home, but also at the Delaware Water Gap in 1853, producing a series of landscape photographs just before his death the following year. And the 1850s were a decade of transition for photography as paper processes began to be adopted more broadly. By the mid-1850s, the combination of two newer processes, the wet collodion glass negative and the albumen print, eventually took over as the dominant process in use over the course of the 19th century. The glass negative gained far more converts in America than the paper negative, as it combined the clarity of detail and range of tone seen in the daguerreotype with the advantages of the positive negative system that could produce multiple prints. American photographers also in the 1850s began to cohere as an active community into an active community with photographic societies, dedicated photography journals, and multiple exhibition venues beginning to be established. With the gradual shift to paper, landscape began to emerge as a vibrant photographic genre in the East. The new adopters of glass and paper processes sought natural features for their subjects. These included the White Mountains, the Delaware Water Gap, the Hudson River, and Niagara Falls, areas accessible to the main urban centers of photography of New York, Boston, and Philadelphia by newly built roads, bridges, and railroads, and promoted as scenic sites to visit by journals and guidebooks. At the same time, however, photographers also trained their cameras on the evolving urban and suburban environment, making pictures that capture the dynamic growth of cities and the attendant drive to offset urban bustle with the establishment of municipal green spaces, such as large-scale parks like the Boston Common, Philadelphia's Fairmount Waterworks, and New York's Central Park. The urban view was one of the strongest themes to emerge with the shift to paper processes, concentrating on the integration of landscape and the built environment in and near the city. James Wallace Black was one of the first to make an extended series of landscape prints on paper. In 1854, he journeyed to the White Mountains, and he was also then the first to photograph that area extensively since Bemis had over 10 years before. In the intervening years, the New Hampshire region had become an even more popular tourist destination, with the first railroad arriving there in 1851 and a number of resort hotels catering to visitors. Black represented the rocky and tree-strewn mountainsides with no signs of civilization visible, such as in his view taken in Crawford Notch, the same again that we saw earlier in Bemis's earlier daguerreotype and Cole's painting. Notably, however, Black also made many views of the farms and towns nestled in the area and the roads that traversed it, as in the photograph on the right. Together, Black's photographs serve almost as a travelogue of the area, and indeed, his choice of subjects echo the way in which the New Hampshire area and the picturesque locations and other picturesque locations were described by contemporary travel writers. Black's interest in the comfortable coexistence of wild land and human settlement reflected the grand narrative of America as a landscape that should be traveled through and taken in by the mastery of the eye. In the late 1850s and early 1860s, New Orleans-based J. Dearborn Edwards produced prints of the bustling city, which, as evident in the photograph Steamer Princess, emphasized the commerce and industry of the city, just as Easterly was doing contemporaneously in St. Louis. And here you see the bales of cotton brought in from slave plantations on the dock in front of the steamship. Many of Edwards' other photographs, however, focus on the streets of New Orleans, calling attention to the overall urban environment and the way that open space interacts with the volumes of buildings. Bird's eye view of Garden District from the Fire Tower, for example, is composed to impart a sense of the neighborhood's blocks and how they fit together. Edwards' photographs communicated not just the prosperous life of the city, but also its growth and expansion. George Kendall Warren forged a unique career in 19th century America by catering to university students. Based in Massachusetts, beginning in 1858, he made photographic portraits of the graduating classes of colleges such as Harvard, Yale, and West Point, but he also specialized in striking architectural and landscape views around each campus. Seniors selected both portraits and views to bind into personal albums, thus founding the tradition of the college yearbook. Warren's views not only sold the college campus and its environs as an idyllic site, but images of it as the material symbol of past experience. By encouraging graduating students to collect both the portraits of their peers, the physical sites they had inhabited, and the views they had enjoyed, Warren was one of the first to transform the landscape photograph into a tangible repository of memory. Also in the 1850s and 1860s, in the broader art world, cross currents with Britain were yielding a new awareness of the writing of art critic John Ruskin. Ruskin's first volume of Modern Painters had been published in 1843, in which, in a famous passage, he exhorted his readers to go to nature, quote, rejecting nothing, selecting nothing, and scorning nothing, unquote. His ideas linking the faithful observation of nature with a higher religious and moral dimension electrified American landscape painters already drawn to the representation of their native landscape. One of these painters, William James Stillman, was influential in disseminating Ruskin's writings to America through the journal The Crayon, which he co-founded in 1855, and he also took up photography in the late 1850s. Soon, like Stillman, other photographers adopted the medium who had strong ties to the art world. John Moran, brother of the painter Thomas Moran, and Charles and Edward Bierstadt, brothers of the painter Albert Bierstadt. These photographers garnered copious praise for their images in the early 1860s, and through their work, landscape photography began to cohere as a more aesthetic endeavor, bringing a new understanding of landscape to the medium that allied it more firmly to contemporary developments in painting and helping to further promote a burgeoning market for it. Stillman had begun spending time in the Adirondacks, where he painted his 1854 Saranac Lake, a painting that exhibited Ruskinian hallmarks of clear detail and close observation of nature. Stillman's writing activities had also acquainted him with the influential circle of Boston intellectuals that included Ralph Waldo Emerson, poet James Russell Lowell, and Harvard naturalist Louis Agassiz. In 1858 and 1859, Stillman spent time in the Adirondacks with several of these men, setting up what they called the Philosopher's Camp and forming the Adirondack Club. In 1859, he learned photography from James Wallace Black and brought his camera that summer to both photograph as well as paint the landscape. From this sojourn, he published an extraordinary portfolio of the woods, two of which are on view in the exhibition. Stillman's project was a new departure that cultivated the close study of nature. Indeed, Stillman called these studies rather than views, one of the first times this term, borrowed from the language of painting, was applied to American photography. Here, Stillman was not interested in providing information about the scene before his camera in the sense of locating the viewer within a particular place or how that particular place fit into a larger area, as in the work of Black or Edwards or Warren. Instead, imbued with Ruskinian and transcendentalist Emersonian ideals, Stillman's photographs aimed to endow his intense focus on the minute details of nature with what he later described as, quote, what nature meant when she put such land and rocks and trees together, unquote. Both the aesthetic ideas that Stillman promoted in his writings and his artistically ambitious landscape photographs marked a turning point for American landscape photography by bringing contemporary art theory and photography together. Though Stillman left for Europe soon after, where he suffered an emotional breakdown under the harsh criticism of Ruskin, causing him to give up painting for most of the remainder of his life, the Philadelphia-based photographer John Moran had a far more sustained career as a landscape photographer in the 1860s. During that decade, he and his brother, the painter Thomas, were sketching and photographing in the areas around Philadelphia, and he made both close-up studies of plants and lucid compositions of the area. Note that the artist sketching in the Wissahickon Creek is very likely Thomas Moran himself. With this background, Moran brought to photography a singular perspective. He, like Stillman, labeled his prints landscape studies. And Moran's pictures parallel the paintings of his brother made contemporaneously, such as the Juniata Evening. Moran also became one of the most prominent advocates for photography as a fine art equal to the status of painting. Moran was not the only photographer working alongside a sibling painter. Charles and Edward Bierstadt established a flourishing photography business in 1859 in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and at times traveled with their brother, the painter Albert. The Bierstadts each spent time in the White Mountains, and in 1860, the brothers collaborated there together on a series of photographs, with Albert credited as selecting the points of view. Only a small number of these prints are now known, with three on view in the exhibition, yet it is evident that the artistic partnership between the brothers yielded an exceptional set of images that, like Moran's, brought a new aesthetic sophistication to photography. Similar to Stillman's pictures, the Bierstadt's photographs concentrate on the contours of rock, wood, and water. In addition to working with his brothers, Albert was producing sketches and drawings in the White Mountains, and eventually a number of paintings, including The Mountain Brook of 1863. Comparing photographs and painting, though the vantage points are slightly different, the compositions convey a sense of depth within the pictorial space. In both, the viewer is positioned as if hovering over the water, as the eye is led directly back into the picture over the course of the water to the glimpses of the sunlight shining down through the trees behind. And during the time that Moran and the Bierstadts were thus reshaping the aesthetics of landscape photography, the nation was in the midst of the most momentous conflict it would face during the century, the Civil War. Though it was not the first war to be fought after the invention of photography, it marked the first sustained use of the medium, both instrumentally and as a means of documentation, with photographers employed by the military as well as in independent capacities. Photography was utilized extensively by Union engineers for surveying, map making, and to copy maps and other documents, though on the Confederate side, there was far less use of photography for such purposes, primarily due to limited material supplies. It was also the first time that photographs were used to publicize war activities to a broader public. And though at the time, photography could not technically, for the most part, record combat action, it offered an unprecedented means by which to frame the modifications, devastation, and ruin wrought on the landscape by battles and the deployment of armies. With the nation in upheaval, the war offered a new challenge to photographers: how to portray and adequately memorialize the epic scale of army life and movement, and the sheer scale of both construction and deconstruction enacted by the use of new technologies, from railroad transportation to lethal weaponry. Captain Andrew J. Russell was an artist who joined the Union Army in 1862. As a special assistant to the United States Military Railroad Construction Corps, he made numerous prints documenting the building of military infrastructure in Virginia and Washington, D.C., showing railroad depots, trestle bridges, arsenals, military headquarters, encampments, hospitals, and batteries. He even documented utilitarian buildings such as army bakeries and hay barns, which marked the vital work undertaken by the Quartermaster's Department to supply the troops, as in the picture that you see here on the left, which is actually in Alexandria. Russell's work discloses the scale of activity and the monumental scope of the Union's endeavors. His 1863 Rebel Rifle Pits Bull Run was made as he was documenting the construction of a new bridge on the site of one that had been destroyed. But unusually for Russell, it sounded a mournful note through the title, which calls attention to the remains of the battle that had taken place there. Alexander Gardner began photographing the war as part of the team assembled by Matthew Brady, who made war pictures for commercial sale, before breaking with Brady to assemble his own group. In 1866, after the war ended, Gardner selected 100 photographs by himself and several others, including Timothy O'Sullivan, who contributed close to half of the negatives, and published the landmark Gardner's Photographic Sketchbook of the War, and a selection of prints from these volumes are featured in the exhibition. Organized chronologically, the images cover the Eastern theater of the conflict, highlighting the activities of the Army of the Potomac from its early losing battles in 1861 to the war's ending at Appomattox. Many pictures celebrate the engineering accomplishments of the Army, such as O'Sullivan's high bridge across the Appomattox, slashing a forceful diagonal across the picture plane. Others struck a more contemplative tone, such as David Woodbury's careful composition of a bridge mirrored in the water. Gardner's sketchbook is an extraordinary record not just of the course of the war, but also of the profound effect the war had on the terrain traversed by the Army. It was, however, George N. Barnard who harnessed the landscape most movingly as an emblem of the war. Barnard issued his own publication in 1866, Photographic Views of Sherman's Campaign, which combined both his work for the military and pictures he made on his own initiative. It thus differed from Gardner's sketchbook as the work of a single artistic vision. Working for the Army in the South, he had photographed sites on Sherman's march to the sea, made for the purpose first documenting topography, railroad building, and fortifications, and second, making a beautiful picture, such as in this print of a trestle bridge at Whiteside. At the war's end, Barnard was able to keep many of his negatives for his own use. But while planning his publication, he felt that he needed more photographs, and he thus returned to the South. The final volume combined photographs that he made from both during and after the war. And photographing soon after the war, rather than in the thick of it, as in the majority of the photographs included in Gardner's compilation, meant that most of Barnard's photographs did not show scenes of camp life or other activity. Few figures appear in this group of photographs, creating a sequence of images remarkable for their stillness. In several, for example, Barnard focused on broken trees or disturbed ground that served as symbols of the events that happened there. And alongside these bereft landscapes, he also included sites of picturesque beauty, such as Lula Lake or the Savannah River, scenes that, in combination with the other photographs, take on an elegiac quality in the wake of the war's destruction. Barnard's portfolio was praised by reviewers for its artistry as much as for its value as containing scenes of interest from the war. But Barnard's accomplishment went far beyond these twin goals. He pursued a vision of the landscape as a site of loss and as the vessel of memory. His pictures are suffused with melancholy. They commemorated the Northern victory even while memorializing the defeated South. Ralph Waldo Emerson, in his seminal 1836 essay, Nature, had asserted that experiencing nature was a way to commune with the divine, but he also claimed it as the raw material that nourishes humanity. Discussing human inventions like the steamship and the railroad, Emerson pointed out that these developments not only sped up the pace of life, but also, in his words, were changing the face of the world. Photography became a tool for this narrative of American invention and change. Alongside the developments of the Civil War and the new attention afforded to the artistic landscape, the 1860s also marked the beginnings of a genre of industrial and railroad views. As both a technological feat in its own right and perceived as an empirical tool for documentation, photography for Americans was the perfect medium to make pictures of the colossal and breathtaking manipulations of the land taking place through the building of railroads, bridges, and other forms of infrastructure and the extraction of natural resources. Pennsylvania provided the initial power behind the Industrial Revolution through the development of the anthracite coal and iron ore mining industries in the northeastern part of the state. Coal not only began to replace wood as the primary source of heating homes across the Northeast, but it was also used to smelt iron and power steam-run machines and the new modes of transportation of steamboats and locomotives. Photographer Thomas H. Johnson moved to Scranton, Pennsylvania in 1863, looking for new opportunities and advertising for orders from coal, iron, and railroad companies. His views of the Delaware and Hudson Railroad and Canal Company, one of the key corporations that developed the anthracite coal interests of northeastern Pennsylvania, comprise a series of large-scale, rich albumen prints of the mining towns and the striking architecture of breakers, the massive buildings constructed to break and sort pieces of coal. His photographs are infused with a sense of wonder at the scale and sheer newness of the environment, such as in Von Storch Breaker, picturing a colliery in Scranton. Waymart, which you see on the right, shows one of the towns that sprang up along the Delaware and Hudson Gravity Railroad. And while it is ostensibly a picture of the town, Johnson's focus is on the stripped land in the foreground, which emphasizes the human activity profoundly transforming the landscape. The railroads were the most profound agents of change in the 19th century, making possible both the transportation of raw material like coal and finished goods, as well as passengers, and opening up whole areas of the country for cultivation, settlement, and tourism. Together, rail and camera ushered in new ways of seeing and experiencing the world. James F. Ryder, who ran a thriving studio in Cleveland, Ohio, was the earliest American photographer to produce a large group of prints on commission for a railroad company. In 1862, he was hired by the Atlantic and Great Western Railway, which was constructing new lines to expand its reach westward through New York, Pennsylvania, and Ohio. Ryder crafted graphic, theatrical compositions by often vigorously centering the tracks, moving back into deep space, and imparting a sense of limitless progression forward. Ryder's intention seems not to have been to record specificity of place, but to conjure a sense of distance traversed and conquered, of production accomplished and forward momentum achieved. Ryder's pictures, along with the contemporaneous Civil War railroad photographs, set the template for a distinctive marrying of train and photographic framing, or railroad vision, in the words of some contemporary scholars. Indeed, many of the photographers, such as Andrew J. Russell, who had been instrumentally involved in documenting the war, went out west as the railroads were extended across the frontier. In the east, photographers too continued to work for the railroad, making images often intended to appeal to potential passengers. They celebrated the distinctive engineering of locomotives, looked for picturesque scenes available from railroad routes, or hailed the technology of the railroad as part of the march of progress. In the 1890s, for example, the Pennsylvania Railroad and the Lehigh Valley Railroad hired Philadelphian William H. Rau. Rau was a successful commercial photographer who made hundreds of large-scale prints for both companies. Provided with a special car outfitted for photographing, Rau often favored elevated viewpoints, setting his camera on top of the rail car or at times building special platforms. His photographs were widely exhibited in hotel lobbies and railroad terminals and used as promotional photographs in newspaper advertisements, postcards, route books, and other material. And just as Ryder had 30 years earlier, Rau too often recorded the iron rails as they recede back in space. By emphasizing the path of the tracks following along the gentle curve of the river in this photograph, Rau visually unifies track and land, perpetuating a vision of the smooth integration of technology and nature. If the railroads occupied a dominant position in 19th century American life, both physically and symbolically, then rivers were of equal importance. Prior to the railroad, rivers had been the primary mode of swift transportation. And though rivers were a natural feature that sustained life, they were also obstacles that had to be navigated and crossed, and resources that could be altered and improved for human benefit. Photography played a role in the transformation of the Upper Mississippi River in the work of Henry Peter Bossy, who was appointed to the Army Corps of Engineers in 1874 as a draftsman. The competition of the railroads had spurred other industries to convince the government to fund improvements on the river from St. Paul to St. Louis. Bossy participated in the survey to assess the feasibility of this task. Then, from 1883 to 1893, Bossy made photographs that recorded the topography of the Upper Mississippi River as it was tamed. The Corps' scheme involved erecting wing and closing dams, visible in this photograph, dredging the river, clearing hazards and obstructions, and building shoreline protection to make a channel for easier navigation. An extraordinary chronicle of the river scenery, Bossy's photographs also showed railroad bridges spanning the waterway, steamships plowing the waters, the railroad and other industries along the banks, as well as dramatic natural scenery. And though Bossy's purpose when making these photographs was documentary and technical as records of the alteration taking place, he clearly expanded his purview into a far more audacious undertaking and approached the landscape with an artist's eye. His exquisite prints were made using a commercial cyanotype paper, and he may have gravitated toward the cyanotype through familiarity with the process from matte making. Yet the deep, rich hues of blue surely deliberately invoked the blue of the mighty river itself. Together, Bossy's pictures convey a sense of potency and force to the expanse of the river, the magnificent Mississippi, in the words of Mark Twain, bearing witness to its transformation from a mythic, Edenic state to industrial artery. Photography that focused on the scenic beauties of different regions also continued to flourish in the decades after the Civil War. Among the foremost photographers of the 1870s and 1880s who became associated with specific places were George Barker in Niagara Falls in Florida, Henry Hamilton Bennett in the Wisconsin Dells, and Seneca Ray Stoddard in the Adirondacks. They sought to push landscape photography in new directions, exploring larger, more dramatic print sizes and more graphic compositions, just as their contemporaries photographing industrial subjects and their Western counterparts were doing. But their work was also deeply entangled with tourism. Barker's photograph of Florida that you see there on the right shows tourists arriving at the resort of Silver Springs. Cultivating the wilderness as a site that served as a respite to urban areas and the built environment, which then encouraged continued development of these areas. The dominance of industry over the American landscape began to give rise to a mitigating impulse toward environmental preservation in which photography would play a role. In the West, not only had Yosemite been declared a national park in 1864, but Yellowstone followed in 1872, and photographs had helped make the case for their preservation. In both of these cases, the areas were protected before much commercial or industrial expansion had taken over. And this was not generally the case with areas in the East, particularly Niagara Falls. George Barker first came to Niagara in the early 1860s, and he became known and widely praised for his muscular mammoth plate views of the falls made in the mid-1880s. But before then, Niagara Falls itself had been under threat from development, which had removed much of the nearby natural vegetation. A group spearheaded by Frederick Law Olmsted called attention to the degradation of the area, eventually persuading the New York legislature to commission a state survey. Barker made images for the landmark 1880 publication of their findings, which bear witness to the environmental degradation there, one of the first uses of photography for this purpose. One of Barker's views, labeled Repulsive Scenery around visitor approaching Goat Island Bridge for first view of rapids, showed the ugly components nearby that were ruining the idealized spectacle of the falls. The report led to the New York State Legislature establishing the Niagara Falls State Park in 1882. Settling in the small village of Glens Falls, New York, Seneca Ray Stoddard was very active from the 1870s onward in encouraging tourism to the Adirondacks, which were in a period of transition from hosting rough settlements of hunters and logging camps to becoming a luxurious retreat for urban dwellers. Stoddard published guidebooks, which, along with his photographs, did much to shape perceptions of the Adirondacks as an area of serene beauty, as in these two pictures, which deftly balance the cliffs and tree-covered hillsides with the luminous sky and water. In Drowned Lands of the Lower Rockette, however, Stoddard presents a haunting picture of stripped and destroyed tree trunks and felled branches. In the 1880s, Stoddard became increasingly critical of the threat to the area posed by the timber industry. In 1892, he used his photography to advocate for the preservation of the region when he presented a lecture illustrated with lantern slides to the New York State Assembly, which then passed a law creating the Adirondack Park. Stoddard's contemporary, Henry Hamilton Bennett, was even more instrumental in creating the Wisconsin Dells as a scenic site and tourist destination. Whereas the Adirondacks were already well known to the public, and Stoddard helped further mold an existing mythology, the Wisconsin Dells were almost entirely unknown terrain when Bennett began operating a photography studio in a small town on the Wisconsin River. Bennett was a deliberate photographer, building platforms or suspending his camera by ropes to position it for the view that he wanted, and waiting for the best light to illuminate the textures of the Dell sandstone formations. Bennett's photographs, like Stoddard's, shaped the way that the Wisconsin Dells were perceived, positioning the area simultaneously as among America's wild romantic landscapes and a picturesque destination made accessible by development to be enjoyed. Several technological changes were afoot in the last three decades of the 19th century. The introduction of the gelatin dry plate negative began to change the field. Becoming widely available by the late 1870s, these negatives shortened exposure times and could be factory made and purchased by the potential photographer ready to use, thus exponentially increasing the availability of photography. Though America had always had amateur photographers since 1839, new developments like this allowed far more people to take up photography as a pastime rather than a profession, and led to the proliferation and growth of camera clubs in cities across the country, as seen in this page from an album showing excursions made by the Photographic Society of Philadelphia in 1877 and 1882. And in 1888, George Eastman's introduction of the Kodak camera eventually made photography available to anyone who could afford one. The Kodak, for the first time, offered a portable, handheld camera that required very little technical knowledge to use, as the camera came loaded with roll film that the company would then develop for the customer, advertising it with the famous slogan, "You press the button, we do the rest." Professional photographers were hard hit by this competition. One of the reasons that photographers such as Barker, Stoddard, and Bennett adopted larger prints was as a means to differentiate their artistry and skill from amateurs. While they used photography to promote visiting scenic destinations as a leisure pursuit for the growing numbers of the prosperous middle class, taking photographs with the newer, easier-to-use cameras became a leisure activity in its own right, just one of many outdoor pursuits that could be pursued at places like the Adirondacks and the Wisconsin Dells. By the end of the century, these photographers all found their businesses threatened. Moreover, whereas Stoddard, Bennett, Barker, Rao, and others of their generation worked at the intersection of art and commerce, amateurs were free from such pressures. By the 1880s and even more into the 1890s, ambitiously artistic amateurs also had to find new ways to distinguish their work from that of the snap-shooting masses. Newer print processes were introduced, such as platinum and gum dichromate, which required darkroom skill and allowed more darkroom manipulation, thus offering fresh tools for photographers to attempt to make their prints more akin to printmaking and painting. Two examples by painters turned photographer are George Bacon Wood Jr.'s haunting platinum print of the grounds of a Pennsylvania estate and Arthur Wesley Dow's elegant composition of haystacks showing the influence of Japanese woodblock prints. A new movement emerged called pictorialism, which focused on genre scenes and picturesque landscapes suggestive of a pre-industrial past, emphasized the importance of the craft of printmaking, and looked to nature as a vehicle for self-expression. By the mid-1890s, several camera clubs began to hold juried exhibitions of works, showcasing pictorialist work side by side with views by professional photographers such as William H. Rao. Alfred Stieglitz began to establish a reputation in these exhibitions. In 1898, Stieglitz made a nocturnal photograph of New York, an icy night, which encapsulated his ideal that photography should produce pictures that expressed a universal or poetic truth rather than an empirical one. Stieglitz's protege, Edward Steichen, moreover, produced one of his earliest works, Wood's Twilight, also that same year. In both of these works, the ambitious photographers gave no indication of place in their titles and obscured any specificity of locale. These meditative prints navigated toward a yet new direction for photography, using landscape as their vehicle, which valued the aesthetic characteristics of the picture determined by the eye of the photographer over the recording of what was in front of the camera. The landscape view that surveyed the scene and optimistically wedded nature and culture, wilderness and industrialization was on the wane. The exhibition ends with Stieglitz and Steichen's pictures, which were a harbinger of the formal modernism that the two photographers would pursue over the next several decades. A new definition of landscape photography had arrived that coincided with the end of the 19th century and pointed to the future of photography at the dawn of the 20th. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.